Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. The 2016 presidential race is in full swing, with a fierce battle for both the Democratic and Republican nominations for president. This race has been absolutely amazing. Remarkably, Donald Trump has a commanding lead in the contest to be the Republican presidential nominee. Hillary Clinton is on track to be the first woman presidential nominee of a major party in history. Bernie Sanders, the first openly Democratic socialist candidate to run seriously in almost 100 years, has generated enormous interest and support. In what has been a dramatic election season, the Republican primary has ranged from demagoguery to carnival to high school food fight. But let's be clear. Despite the appearance of a reality TV show and spectacle, the presidential race has become a battle over who we are as Americans and indeed over the future of America. We face important questions. Is the popularity of Donald Trump due to a rise in American authoritarianism? Can Donald Trump be stopped? Will the Democrats unite behind the nominee and turn out to vote in November to beat the Republicans and win the White House? Here to help us understand what's happening and what it means for us is Harold Meyerson, one of the country's leading political analysts. Harold Meyerson is editor-at-large of the American Prospect, one of the top political magazines in the country. For the past 13 years, he has written a weekly op-ed column for the Washington Post. Previously, he was executive editor of the LA Weekly, the nation's largest metropolitan weekly. His articles on politics, labor, the economy, foreign policy, and American culture have also appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New Republic, The Nation, The New York Times, and many other publications. Harold Meyerson, welcome back to All Together Now.
Always good to be here, Eleanor.
Yeah, I am so excited to be talking to you about this race. I think it's a pivotal moment, really, in the race and in American history. So much to cover. Let's start with Donald Trump. We know Trump has behaved like a bully and a demagogue. He wants to ban Muslims from coming into the country. He wants a police force to deport 11 million Hispanics. He denigrates anyone who disagrees with him, threatening to punch people in the face and having them forcibly removed from his events. It seems to me Trump is disturbing and scary. So how come he is leading the race to be the presidential nominee of the Republican Party?
Well, he's touched a nerve in part of the population, and it's a real part. Not to put too fine a point on it, it's a large chunk of the white working class, which has been absolutely on the downside of the economy for many years. Certainly, among white working class men, among the leading victims of offshoring, of deindustrialization. And feeling estranged, and this has been actually measurable since the mid-1960s, increasingly estranged from a Democratic Party which has promoted rights for other races, actually, and has also been the prime viewership for really propaganda outlets like Fox News and listenership for radio talk show hosts like Rush Limbaugh, who've been telling them that that their problems are the fault of immigrants, of minorities. And so along comes Trump with a program, with an appeal that works on a couple levels. Sort of programmatically, it's very similar to the appeal that has roused the European populist right. Parties like the National Front in France, Le Pen's party, whose core supporters are either old industrial workers who used to vote communist in France, or the populist parties in other countries that are raging against immigration and the European Union, really affirming But defending the welfare states in all of these European countries for them. And Trump departs from traditional Republican doctrine in some interesting ways. He's alone in the Republican field and saying he doesn't want to cut Social Security, he doesn't want to cut Medicare. He makes a big deal, like most progressives have, about the trade deals that have really hurt working class Americans. But like the rest of the populist right, he places the stigma for this on Muslims, on Mexicans, and so on. And the way he talks about trade deals, it's very interesting. He says, you know, China has cleaned our clock. Mexico has cleaned our clock. Well, actually, it was American business that insisted on those trade deals. I mean, China and Mexico didn't really have much lobbying clout when we passed NAFTA, when we enacted permanent normal trade relations with China. That was American business, a little detail that Trump omits from his diagnosis of what went wrong. So there's sort of a ready-made constituency for him there. And then, as you noted, there have been a number of surveys that shows the one best predictor of whether a voter is inclined to vote for Trump is that voter's essential affinity for authoritarianism, authoritarian solutions. And you have to say, I mean, this is a cultural thing, but it also isn't happening in a political vacuum. At a time when the federal government is obviously gridlocked, and people are trying to figure out how the hell does anything get passed at the federal level, if a guy comes along who basically, you know, has this authoritarian aura and says, I'm, you know, enough of a thug, in essence, to get stuff through. I don't think that, by the way, is true, but if that's his appeal, you can see the appeal of that rising as well due to the political stagnation that besets the federal level of government. So, you know, those are among the reasons why Trump is really running amok on the Republican side and likely to win the Republican nomination.
That is an excellent analysis, and I think kind of along with that, when I listen to Trump, he just comes out with he seems like a strong man, I can do this, and he makes all these promises, I'll make sure everyone has health care, I'll make sure everyone has jobs, I'll make sure America wins, and it's almost comical because it's just these kind of simplistic slogans, and he's got nothing to back it up. He has no health care plan. He doesn't ever say how he's going to do what he's claiming he's going to do, but I think people find it very reassuring. They think he's strong and smart and successful, so I think you're right. You know, he can cut through the gridlock and get things done and make America strong again, kind of a thing. And I think those simplistic solutions appeal to people when they're feeling besieged and frustrated.
Yeah, and if anything, the absence of any program, you know, is certainly a problem for a number of voters, but for other voters, it just serves to emphasize the degree to which he's different. So, you know, I mean, in a sense, if you've got a political program, then you're, if not part of the establishment, at least you're playing the traditional political game. You actually have a proposal on what to do about X, Y, and Z. Trump really doesn't have that, except, you know, build a wall, make Mexico pay for it, and cut better trade deals. So that serves to set him apart all the more, and that's one of the things that his supporters, I think, find appealing about him, at least at this stage of the campaign. But I think that's certainly sufficient to carry him through to the Republican nomination.
Right. I heard an interview earlier this week with someone from Germany who had been there when Hitler was on the rise, and he was saying that it reminded him, this kind of support for Trump reminded him of the support for Hitler. And apparently, when Hitler was coming along, the educated people apparently dismissed him as a clown because he just, you know, didn't seem like a really serious candidate. But that actually Hitler became quite popular by appealing to people's prejudice and promising to be the strong man that would reinvigorate their economy and their lives, and rose to power. What do you think of the Trump-Hitler comparison?
Well, I think it's a little over the top to compare anyone substantively to Hitler. I mean, even though he flirts with refusing to condemn the KKK, Trump is not the kind of pathological bigot that Hitler clearly was. But there are certainly similarities in their appeals. Hitler did get the German economy going again by having so much armaments and military spending. He was for increasing social benefits. So there's that aspect to Hitler, and also Hitler was came to power at a time when there was a serious communist movement and a serious socialist movement, sort of contesting along with Nazism for the dominant power in Germany. So it was a very polarized time, and the guy with the largest fraction of the public prevailed, and that's really just looked at almost quantitatively. That's sort of what Trump is doing now. He has certainly got the largest fraction on the Republican side. It's still not clear that he commands a majority of Republican support, but it's also not clear that he needs to command a majority of Republican
right.
support. A strong plurality should suffice to get him the nomination, and if there's enough opposition to attempt to block it, the Republican convention will be one of the great Donnybrooks of all time. And of course, in the last few days, we've seen different groups in the Republican Party raise the possibility of maybe putting up a third candidate in the fall election. To save the honor, such as they conceive it, of the Republican Party. So, as you play this forward, there don't seem to be too many happy outcomes for the Republican Party in its current state.
Yeah. Well, you make a really important point there that Trump, he hasn't gotten the majority anywhere in any of the states. He has
although
been the
he came
lead.
Close in your home state.
I am embarrassed to admit it. 49% of the Republican Party in Massachusetts voted for Trump.
Yeah.
It's true. But we're proud that it did not crack the 50. But if you look
across...
That
is a low bar for pride, Eleanor.
True. But it's actually a fascinating race in Massachusetts this year, which is almost usually kind of a given. Everybody knows what Massachusetts is going to do, but it kind of surprised people, both the Democratic and Republican primaries this year for different reasons. But I do think it's important to note that Trump has not gotten over 50% in any state. It's just because there's been so many candidates that he's his 35 to 40% is enough to thrust him into the front because he's getting it everywhere. But still, it's not to diminish him. As you say, having a plurality looks like it's probably going to be enough to get Trump the Republican nomination. And I've been fascinated to watch the Republicans now scrambling. I mean, it seemed like they, along with everybody else, was kind of dismissing Trump earlier and not bothering to criticize him or try to take him down. But now the Republicans are really scrambling to stop him. There was a speech today that former Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney gave in Utah where he called Trump a phony and a fraud. And I'll give you a quote from that remarkable speech by Governor Romney. And he said about Trump, quote, "His promises are as worthless as a degree from Trump University. He's playing members of the American public for suckers. He gets a free ride to the White House, and all we get is a lousy hat." So what do you see happening among the Republicans now with the fracturing there in terms of some of them trying to stop Trump?
Well, here's how I see that. The fracturing exists within the anti-Trump camp or camps as well. It seems to me there are two or maybe three kinds of Republicans who are decidedly in the anti-Trump camp. First of all, there are the hardline social conservatives who have mainly been voting for Ted Cruz, who don't trust Trump's bona fides as a social conservative. They know, for instance, that he has had things to say about Planned Parenthood that in which he's praising it as well as condemning it. So that's one camp. The second camp are the much beloved neocons who got us into the Iraqi war, we would agree with him on this. I would, are appalled that he's, had really nothing positive, nothing negative, and some positive things to say about his fellow strongmen like Vladimir Putin, and clearly would have kind of a non-interventionist, semi-isolationist foreign and military policy, which is anathema to them. And I think they're the group that has been talking most about setting up possibly a third party run. The editor of the Weekly Standard, William Kristol, has been saying this for some time now. And then third are the relative, and I emphasize the word relative, moderates still remaining in the Republican Party, who are, appalled at the racism and semi-demi-neo-fascism of Trump. The closest they have as a champion in the current Republican field would be John Kasich, the governor of Ohio. These are distinct camps. And if you want to play out, well, maybe that can be a third party Republican alternative to Trump. Well, which of those camps does that person supposed to represent? It's a little fuzzy. And the perils of trying to represent all of them are completely illustrated by the sort of ridiculous, from a strategic point of view, the ridiculous campaign that Marco Rubio has run for president. He's tried to be a social conservative, but appealing to the more moderates, to all this. And what's happened as a result is he's been most Republicans' second or third choice when they get around to voting, and so he's tended to come in virtually everywhere except the Minnesota caucuses, either second or third on this past Tuesday. To his further woes, of which there are many, in many states it was third. And he was supposed to be the consensus candidate. Well, he was a consensus at a level of the third tier. The Republican fracturing is really profound and most clearly exposed in the fact that Trump's base really doesn't go along with a lot of traditional Republican economics. They're not there for the free trade stuff. They're not there for slashing the retirement security and things like that. So it's a party in which almost every tendency has its own direction this year. And most successful political parties, like the Republicans in the past, are usually able to, paper this over, come up with some kind of compromise. Not this year. It's going to be tough for them to, stop Trump either, before the convention or those who want to do it after the convention. Some of them are talking about Robert Kagan, the neocon writer, has said he would vote for Hillary Clinton over Trump, and there are no doubt some Republicans who will do that.
Yeah, I think that's true. I actually had dinner this week with one of my friends who was in the leadership in the Congress as a Republican, and I was astonished to hear him say he's very upset about Trump looking like he's going to be the nominee for the Republican Party. And he actually told me he would rather vote for Bernie Sanders than Donald Trump.
Find that man up.
Yeah, but he wouldn't vote for Hillary Clinton. So I think there's a deep hatred among many, or even sensible Republicans, about Hillary. But it seems to me this Republican attack is way too little, way too late, and that Trump, even with his 35% that he's getting everywhere, that's going to be enough to get him enough of the delegates at the Republican convention this July to get the Republican nomination. Do you think he's going to get it?
I do. I mean, there are some tests coming up, and we'll see if he passes them. On March 15th, there are a number of primaries that for the first time are winner-take-all by state, notably in Florida, which is Marco Rubio's home state, and in Ohio, which is a state of which John Kasich is still a presumably rather popular governor, certainly among Republicans there. So it will matter somewhat on who wins those primaries. Rubio is considerably trailing Trump in Florida, which I think would knock him out if he loses the Florida primary to Trump. Ohio is closer, and it would slow down Trump a little if he loses one of those states. Ohio is the smaller of the two. But it's hard to see Kasich, who has done things like accepted the Medicare expansion of Obamacare, actually rallying that many people in what is a very conservative party today, the Republican Party, to his banner. Ted Cruz probably would actually be a weaker candidate in November than Donald Trump, and he has managed to personally estrange almost everyone in the Republican establishment. So most of the people who are shaking their heads about Trump, except for the social conservatives, wouldn't feel significantly warmer to Cruz. So, I mean, the party is really in a bind. But it is mathematically possible that Trump will come into the Republican convention with a strong plurality, but not yet a majority. And that is really a prescription for all hell breaking loose at the Republican convention.
It couldn't happen to a nicer bunch.
No, it couldn't. It couldn't. Because, I mean, you know, he is the creation of all the demagogues who mainstream Republicans have been a part of for years. I mean, anyone who's condemning Trump today but hasn't condemned Fox News and right-wing talk radio for the last 20 years is a good deal of a hypocrite. He's the logical consequence of that. And but if he comes in with a plurality and not a majority, that is going to be one hell of a convention, and possibly the kind of convention that a short-lived alternative candidacy, an independent candidacy, a third-party candidacy, spins out of.
Yeah, I think that's entirely likely. I mean, given that Trump's been getting about the 35% mark in most states, and it is possible, as you say, in Ohio. Governor Kasich is a popular governor among Republicans there. Maybe Ohio will vote for him, number one, and give him a big chunk of delegates. It is possible won't have enough going into the convention to win it on the first ballot, and then, of course, the delegates are free to vote for who they want.
Yeah, but if Trump comes in still running first, which I'm almost certain will be the case, and is then denied the nomination, you can imagine the possibility of his running as an independent, and whether he does or not, his people, his supporters, are not going to back that Republican nominee, which is to say the Republican nominee's potential support would probably be cut by 40%, which would be obviously fatal to that person's prospects.
Right, exactly. And I've heard some talk recently about if the Republicans can stop Trump from getting the nomination on the first ballot, that then it becomes wide open, and really the delegates could vote for whoever they want. And even some are saying, "Well, let's bring Mitt Romney back."
But, I don't think they would bring Mitt Romney back. If they do that, I think the more logical winner would be Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House.
Right.
Who, by the way, will be chairing the convention, and in which case he may need to wear, you know, a suit of armor. But it's also the case that the Trump people would be furious. They'd walk out.
Right.
There'd probably be some fights on the floor of the convention, and I don't mean, you know, political fights. I mean physical fights. And, it would be a doomed enterprise. As I said, the prospects facing the Republican Party at this juncture are not notably happy in any way you game this out.
Right, exactly. Let's talk about the Democratic side for a little bit. We've got Senator Bernie Sanders, who's run a fabulous campaign and gotten lots of enthusiastic support, particularly among young voters. And it seems to me it's been a real resurgence of progressive politics. But as we talked about earlier, Bernie lost even by just a whisker of 1.5% there in liberal Massachusetts. So Do you think the campaign by Senator Sanders is over? Do you see any scenario where Bernie can win the nomination for the Democrats for president?
No to both of those questions. The campaign is not over, and I have trouble seeing how he could win the nomination. I mean, keep in mind, Bernie essentially decided to run because he wanted to promote some issues, his worldview, his critique of the way the economy is rigged and how mainstream politics has more or less accommodated the rigging of the economy. And, you know, he has enough support that there's no reason for him to stop that. He could, under the worst scenario, he could stay in, he could go to the convention with at least a third of the delegates, quite possibly more, raise some good points in the platform, and then endorse Hillary as a, you know, which I'm sure he will do, so as to, you know, defeat the Donald Trumps of this world. But if he were to drop out now, I mean, I think his supporters, and particularly his young supporters, would feel a sense of betrayal, of disenchantment. I mean, remember, this is a guy who raised more money than anyone else just this last month in February. He outraised Hillary, outraised anyone on the Republican side, all in small donations. He has a ton of very passionate supporters. And given what he, I think, how he defines his primary mission, which is this revolution, not the presidential election, it would be a betrayal to that revolution, as he defines it, for him to walk away. That said, can he win the nomination? Well, I mean, I think Massachusetts was illustrative. He basically can win in what we might call the Great White North. Hillary has substantial support, which I don't think Sanders has. He's clearly not been able to dent very much so far, and I think that that will probably continue to be the case going forward. Tuesday's primary in Texas, we got the first real indication of Latino voting from the exit polls, and Latinos in Texas backed Hillary over Bernie by a 71% to 29% margin, which is about 15% lower than her support in the African American community, but still pretty decisive. So I think Bernie's strength as he goes forward is going to be near the Canadian border. Wisconsin, Minnesota, Washington, Oregon, and progressives everywhere, and young people everywhere. But that's not enough, really, for him to, win the nomination in the Democratic Party.
Interesting. Yeah, and Bernie has just had such a strong campaign and raised so many important points and gotten, as you say, a phenomenal amount of money. Who would imagine there'd be Bernie Sanders would earn raise more money than Hillary Clinton in the last stretch. And I think with Bernie being in there, he's definitely made Hillary Clinton a much better candidate. I think he's sharpened her debate skills, which seemed to be a little rusty at the beginning. He's moved her to the left economically, which I think is all going to make her a stronger candidate in the general election and give more energy to the Democratic base. Do you agree? What impact?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at her position on trade, you look at her position on infrastructure, you look at her position in which she now, you know, criticizes banks and corporations, that's a result of two things. It's a result of Bernie being a very effective candidate, pushing those points. And it's also the result of really a separate story, which is huge, which is the leftward movement of the Democratic Party generally. And I've been writing about this in different places. If you look at the polling, the share, the percentage of Democrats now identifying themselves as liberal has increased tremendously in the last decade or so, even to the point where in the exit polls for the Super Tuesday primaries this past Tuesday, in every southern state, in Georgia and Alabama, a majority of Democrats describe themselves as liberal. So that really signals a couple of things. Just the leftward movement of Democrats in response to what the economy is. And in the South, it also reflects the fact that a lot of folks who used to be Democrats, particularly white folks, are now Republicans. And so that makes the party more liberal by subtraction as well, you know, as opposed to by addition or conversion or what have you. Similarly, the thing that's been astonishing me most is the rising share of Democrats who now describe themselves as socialist. Now, none of these polls that this has shown up on has actually asked them, well, are you a socialist or are you a liberal? So a lot of folks are clearly answering both. But we know from the polling, the entrance polling in Iowa and the exit polling in New Hampshire. In Iowa, 43% of the Democrats who took part in the caucus had said, yeah, I'm a socialist. In New Hampshire, in the primary, which is a bigger audience, a bigger group than caucus goers, it was 31%. And in South Carolina, there was a Bloomberg poll that showed it was at, among Democrats, 39%. This is in South Carolina, where if you poll the population as a whole, you'll probably find 39% support for reinstating slavery. This is really a kind of a phenomenal leftward movement on the part of the base of the Democratic Party on economic issues, basically. No one has asked all of these self-proclaimed socialists what they mean by that. When Bernie Sanders gave a speech at Georgetown University in November on his definition of socialism, he basically cited Social Security and Medicare, which among other things meant the conflation of liberalism with social democracy with socialism was almost complete. Looked at from a distance, which I think is how you have to do this, it reflects a general leftward movement on the part not just of the Democratic base, but if you look at the things that leading centrist Democratic thinkers like Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary, have been writing, the Center for American Progress, which is a think tank that whose leaders are rather close to Hillary Clinton, and whose founder John Podesta is actually the chair of the Clinton campaign. They're certainly talking about more progressive economic policies than was common in the Democratic Party a decade ago or so, or even 5 years ago. So she's reflecting all of that, and she's reflecting really the effectiveness of Bernie Sanders' really kind of stunning campaign.
Yeah, it has been stunning, and Bernie is a proud Democratic socialist, and that has seemed to enhance rather than take away from his support. I mean, there was a time someone was charged with, accused, so to speak, of being a Democratic socialist in a presidential race would be the kiss of death, but it just seems to be putting wind under his wings. How would you define democratic socialism, and why do you think there's such a rise in kind of the self-definition of liberal and socialist now in the country?
Well, I would define it as democratizing the economy and taking some basic economic questions out of the control of the market and putting it in control of a more democratic sphere, which sometimes is the state and sometimes is workers. So, when Bernie says that healthcare is a right, not a privilege, that certainly is a basic socialist idea. One change in socialism, which people who haven't been following it, which is to say 98% of the American people, have generally not fully grasped over the last 50, 60 years, has been its decoupling from the original idea of the public ownership of the means of production. Pretty much all of the Western European social democratic, socialist, and labor parties at one point in the post-World War II era repudiated that and said, well, we're still going to have an economy that's part market, part state. We're gonna have these social benefits. We're not going to have your access to health care or retirement or child care dependent upon your ability to pay for it. We may have public ownership of certain things like utilities and so on, but we're not gonna be controlling the steel industry, the auto industry, or the store on the corner. And that's pretty much in accord, I think, with what Bernie articulates day in, day out on the stump. I think there are three reasons for why most Americans have found it not as difficult as it used to be by a factor of a lot to proclaim oneself a socialist these days. One is that Sanders is not running as a third-party candidate, like Ralph Nader, so a potential threat to elect a Republican by splitting the left-of-center vote. And this has actually been a tenet of the major socialist organization, which is not that major, but it's what's there in the United States, the Democratic Socialists of America, ever since Michael Harrington founded it, or its predecessor organization, at the end of the 1960s. They sort of may as well be openly socialist within the Democratic Party, because that's where, you know, there are a lot of social democratic forces, Harrington wrote back in 1972, already in the Democratic Party, by which he meant many of the major unions and so on. But they have to play in the Democratic Party because of our two-party system and any number of reasons. So that's one reason. The second reason is that the, you know, the menacing totalitarian pretender to the socialist throne, Soviet communism, has ceased to exist in classic form in most places since 1991. And so when millennials, who have been, you know, increasingly calling themselves socialist and backing Bernie Sanders, when millennials call, think of socialism, they don't think of the Soviet Union. They think of these Western European countries where you can go to college for free and get child care as a right, and things like that that would make their lives a lot easier. So that's the second thing. And then the third thing, I think we need to go back to sort of the first real definitive essay on the question of socialism in America, which was an essay written in 1906 by a German sociologist named Werner Sombart. And Sombart's idea was that this was at a time when there was, you know, huge immigration to the United States from Central and Eastern and Southern Europe, people moving to the United States and ending up working in sweatshops or in god-awful steel factories, what have you, but that it was still better than wherever it was they came from, Russia, Italy, the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And, you know, that it was more prosperous even given that. And so his famous line in his essay, which he entitled, "Why Is There No Socialism in the United States?" was, "On the reefs of roast beef and apple pie, all socialist utopias smash and come to grief." And what's happened in the last, particularly since 2008, but even before that, is the vanishing of whatever today's equivalent of roast beef and apple pie is, or are, for all but the wealthiest Americans. And Americans are cognizant of this. It's one, you know, and I think that's feeding, on the one hand, the support for Bernie, the percentage of Americans identifying themselves as socialism, but even it's feeding in its own warped way the support for Donald Trump. His supporters know that, you know, if 30 years ago they could actually have been working in a unionized auto factory and, you know, making what was then called a family wage, you know, that those jobs are gone now, and there's nothing that pays equivalently. The middle class has shrunk in terms of the percentage of people in it and the percentage of money that the people in it have. So, the reefs of roast beef and apple pie ain't there no more, and that makes a real difference.
Yeah, that's a fascinating analysis. And the roast beef and apple pie, you say, it is happening for more people in some of those socialist countries, so you can see the appeal. I don't know if you've seen Michael Moore's new film that just came out a couple of weeks ago called Where Should We Invade Next? And, you know, Michael Moore, I like some of his stuff, but some of it's just way over the top and in your face for kind of my style. But I thought this recent movie by Michael Moore is the best he's done. And he goes to different countries, including several in Europe, where the young people have free education and they get job training and they have these benefits of, you know, paid parental leave and longer and paid vacations and sick leave. And you look at that and you go, oh, my God, they can do that in Europe. We're supposed to be the richest country in the world. How come we don't have that? And I think when you look at young people asking that, you can see where the whole concept of being more liberal or more socialist has a lot of appeal.
Absolutely. You know, I have some good friends. This married couple, she's German, he's American. They have a son who was raised in both countries. He wanted to get a really good scientific engineering education when he went off to college last year. And they had a choice. He could have gone in the United States, the cost would have been monumental. Or he could have gone in Germany, where the cost was non-existent. And he ended up going to college in Germany. Well, you know, that says something about, among many other things, whether a country views education as a right or a privilege. And that's something that I think a lot of young Americans are confronting these days. Not the choice, but the absence of a choice and the desire for something better and more affordable.
Absolutely. And, you know, who among the youth wants to be an indentured servant paying off your college loans for the rest of your life? I just think, yeah, it's such a key issue. You have another wonderful article on prospect.org this week, and you talk about, as you did earlier in this conversation, Bernie's goal is to strengthen progressives within the Democratic Party. And assuming Bernie does go all the way to the Democratic Convention in July, and I think you're right, I think he will, do you think there's any particular prize that he would be looking for at the convention, or do you think this is more kind of long-term organizing and building pressure from the left?
Well, more the second than the first, but I think at the convention his people will probably propose some platform planks that deal with health care, that deal with infrastructure, things like that. Obviously, he's not angling for something like the vice presidency or a cabinet post. There is an interesting question as to, assuming Hillary is a nominee, who she selects to be her running mate. At the beginning of the year, the general feeling was, well, she's really got to boost Latino turnout and so needs to pick a Latino. I think it's pretty clear that Trump will boost Latino turnout tremendously without any help from the Democrats. So it's not clear that that's the case. But perhaps she may feel the need to go to someone in or close to the Bernie wing of the party for a running mate, in which case people like Elizabeth Warren or Sherrod Brown, senators from Massachusetts and Ohio, respectively, might have their names in the hopper. But more to the point, Bernie is interested in creating a group and a generation of activists who are pushing for the kind of policies he's advocated at all levels of government. Now, there is, presidential campaigns themselves don't really morph into, I think, very successful ongoing organizations. That was a realization that Dan Cantor had, who had played a significant role on the two presidential campaigns of Jesse Jackson in the 1980s. And one reason why he set up the Working Families Party in New York, which now exists in a number of states, to really be that kind of organization. The name Working Families Party is a bit of a misnomer. In New York, they have an odd electoral arrangement where a progressive can be the nominee of both the Democrats and the Working Families Party, but mainly they play within the Democratic Party, their name to the contrary notwithstanding. And I think something like that could be the kind of place where this Sanders generation can find and build a political home and agitate and I think in many cases successfully for progressive policy at the state and local and eventually the national level as well.
Yeah, that very good points. And another thing that's encouraging about Bernie's campaign and really astonishing is that he's raised as much money as Hillary and recently more. And it's almost all from the small donations averaging $27. So it does show that it is possible to counter the big money in politics that was allowed by the Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United to allow unlimited funds. And, of course, we still want to work to overturn Citizens United, but it does mean we don't need to give up hope even while that's still the law of the land.
Well, if you can inspire that level of support, yes. The other thing Bernie has going for him is precisely because the donations have been small, most of his donors are nowhere near hitting the legal ceiling of $2,700 being the maximum you can give to a campaign during either the primary cycle or the general election cycle, so they can keep on giving. Hillary has a lot of donors who are more affluent and who have already hit that limit, so they can't give her any more money. So Bernie has found, you know, the formula for the gift that keeps on giving, which is only a formula if you have lots and lots and lots of impassioned small donors, and that's exactly what he has.
Right. Now, looking ahead to the general election on November 8th, and by the way, I'm going to make it a practice, instead of saying the general election or the presidential election or the election in November, I'm always going to say November 8th because I want all our people to be turning out on November 8th.
Oh, good for you. Good move.
Do you think Hillary, assuming she is the Democratic nominee, do you think she can beat Trump?
Well, there are a lot of variables here. Obviously, if the Republican Party really splits, then yes. You know, at that point, you know, the proverbial dog catcher could beat Trump. But Trump has strengths that a Republican nominee usually doesn't have, and he has weaknesses that a Republican nominee usually doesn't have. Trump will run stronger than Republicans usually run, I think, in a lot of what used to be the industrial Midwest and is now the post-industrial, post-union Midwest. So, for instance, in Pennsylvania, which is a state that has gone Democratic in every presidential election, I think, since 1988, Trump will run stronger in the western part of the state, which is a place of abandoned steel mills and coal mines and what have you. And he'll run weaker in the mainline suburbs of Philadelphia, which is where the more moderate Republican professional upper middle class lives, the sort of stomping grounds for an old moderate Republican like Arlen Specter, let's say. So he has strengths and he has weaknesses. Hillary is obviously a candidate who has all kinds of weaknesses, but I think running against Trump would be a very effective way of boosting Democratic turnout, which he really needs to do. I mean, you know, one of the stories of the year so far is Republicans have been voting in primaries in far greater numbers than the Democrats have. Of course, Republicans, thanks to Trump, have also been getting, you know, vastly much more media attention than the Democrats have. So you can't really say which is, you can't quantify the effect of that. But she has, as you mentioned at the top of the show, there are Republicans who, even if they can't stand Trump, would never vote for Hillary. They just hate her. So she has weaknesses that are both, self-engendered, and I think come from the media piling on to her as far back as 1992, a combination of both of those factors. But I still think if with Trump as a nominee, she has to be favored, but it's not in itself a slam dunk unless, you know, there's a third right-wing candidate in the field.
Yes, and, you know, I think it's looking likely that there may be. You talked about the fracturing. Maybe the Republicans would run a third-party candidate. We know Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York, has made noises about possibly running, although I think Bloomberg said he would run if Bernie Sanders were the Democratic nominee and that Trump were the Republican nominee, then Bloomberg would get in. But
yeah, I don't think Bloomberg would run if Hillary is the nominee, so I think it's unlikely Bloomberg would run. So
if we get a third party, it'll be probably from the Republican side.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, the other factor we have to consider here in the general election on November 8th is, will the Bernie Sanders supporters unite behind Hillary if she is the nominee? And that's, you know, a lot of his base is obviously progressives and a lot of the young people. Do you think they would go over to Hillary if she's the nominee?
Well, what would help that process along would be the Republicans running Trump, because you don't have to be crazy about Hillary. You can even dislike Hillary and still fear the consequences of a Trump victory. So I think that would be a unifying factor. And then, you know, look, Hillary's people really understand that they need Bernie's people in November, they haven't really leveled that many attacks on Bernie relative to what they could do. And I think they're going to try to go out of their way as much as possible to play nice henceforth and through the convention. And as I said, one thing, if they're really concerned about losing a large chunk of Bernie supporters and want to shore up that base, they could always make a gesture in picking a running mate like, say, Elizabeth Warren. So, so we'll see. But, I mean, there are a lot of variables here. But I think the biggest variable is with Trump being the nominee, that is something that would scare the bejesus out of the Bernie supporters as well as the Hillary supporters. And that would certainly help her cause.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, you think about if Hillary is the nominee and picks Elizabeth Warren as the vice presidential nominee, it's going to be the first time not only the woman headed the ticket, but that there'd be two women on the ticket. But I think, you know, who knows? Maybe it'll happen.
I think that would be, that would happen only if they're really concerned about having to win back Bernie supporters. So we shall see.
Yeah. Now, this whole presidential race is affecting the entire election this year, and a lot of the Senate seats are up. What chance do you think the Democrats have of regaining majority? You think the chances are better for the Democrats to take over if Trump is the Republican nominee?
Well, yeah, because I think there are some Republicans who will just throw up their hands and not go to the polls under those conditions, or take the converse if there is a, you know, if Trump is a nominee, every Republican member of Congress this year is going to have to either endorse Trump or not endorse Trump. Either way, that person is going to really estrange a clump of otherwise, you know, supportive voters. So that poses a problem. I note that one of the few members of Congress to endorse Trump so far comes from that terrain around western Pennsylvania that I was talking about, where most of the Republicans in an area like that heavily support Trump. But, you know, I mean, most Republicans come from districts where their constituents or Republican constituents are divided. So it really is a flashpoint, I think, for Republicans running for Senate in swing states like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Illinois this year. Well, in Illinois, I think Mark Kirk would probably not endorse Trump. But, you know, I mean, that will cost him some votes. So, yes, it augurs well for the Democrats, offsetting that to a certain degree. I've been reading about, you know, there are some big money Republican donors who had figured on giving their customary gazillion dollars to the Republican presidential campaign who may not do this year, but they may then throw that money into senatorial campaigns. So, they giveth and they taketh away. But it will pose a real dilemma for down-ticket Republicans if Trump is a nominee.
Yes. And speaking of the Senate, we know that Justice Scalia recently passed away, creating a vacancy on the Supreme Court. And it was astonishing that within an hour of Justice Scalia passing, the Republican leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, was saying that he would not even hold hearings on a nominee to replace him on the Supreme Court. Do you expect President Obama to nominate a Supreme Court justice, or what do you see happening on that battle?
Oh, sure. I mean, politically, it's all to his advantage to do so. He's not going to anger anyone who already isn't a diehard Republican. And, you know, I'm sure it's going to be someone who is a politically attractive person. And it really puts another Republican.
You mean politically attractive to the Republicans?
No. He'll do someone who, you know, looks like a really plausible Supreme Court justice to any but, you know, the Republicans. And it's going to put Charles Grassley, who was one of those Republicans running for reelection, really on the spot. He's the chair of the senator from Iowa, and he's the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is the committee that holds hearings for judicial nominees. According to one of the papers I read today, and I don't remember which, I read too many papers, a really strong Democratic opponent has just announced her candidacy within the last day in Iowa. So Grassley has got to be, for Grassley, this is like the Trump nomination. You're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. You're going to piss off some people who otherwise would vote for you no matter whether you decide to hold hearings or not. I'm certain Obama will make a nomination, and this will be a major headache for Charles Grassley.
Yeah, it's amazing to me that the Republicans say, well, we're not going to even consider any nominee from President Obama because it's election year and we need to wait and see, let the people have a voice in it. And as is abundantly clear, the people have had a voice, and we not once but twice elected Barack Obama as president, and part of his responsibility is to nominate Supreme Court justices. So, and just this flagrant disregard for the Constitution and for discharging their responsibilities, to me, is astonishing.
Yeah, but it's also predictable given their demonization of Obama and their sense, which was apparent during Bill Clinton's presidency too, that any Democratic president is in some sense illegitimate. You know, I mean, that's sort of their mindset, and one that their political base is encouraged to believe by right-wing media with each passing day. So it's about what you would expect of these guys.
Good. Well, that's all the time we have. I so appreciate this chance to discuss the presidential election with you and your great insight and brilliance and knowledge. And Harold Morrison, thank you so much for being with us today and for all your great analysis.
Well, thank you very much, Eleanor.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back next Thursday. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor Lacaine with All Together Now. Let's